Committee to order, and we will do a public hearing on Senate Bill 162. Commissioner Roberts.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm Commissioner of the Oregon Bureau of Immigrant Industries. Senate Bill 162, which isn't really our bill, this is we didn't sponsor it, it's at the request of the Oregon University System, but we're involved in this because this has to do with Oregon's prevailing wage rate law. Several years ago, the Oregon System of Higher Education, now Oregon University System, wanted to exempt themselves from a lot of the public contracting laws, which they believed unnecessarily encumbered them with red tape and bureaucracy and the like. So they exempted themselves from a lot of the provisions. At that time, they exempted themselves from coverage of the prevailing wage rate law, but said they would nonetheless pay the prevailing wage rate. The theory was that as long as they paid the rates that would be the same as would otherwise be required, they shouldn't have to follow a lot of the bureaucratic requirements, reporting requirements, and the like. And we were fine with that. What we found in practice is that by relieving them from the supposed paperwork and bureaucracy, we also burdened them with the enforcement responsibility for making sure that people were paying the correct prevailing wage rate as required by law. And so while we did not have the enforcement responsibility, but they did, we were the ones with the enforcement expertise. We tried to work through the rules to see if to give that responsibility back to us, and what we found working with the AG and that is that we don't have the legal authority to enforce their rules, and so they found themselves burdened with an enforcement responsibility they weren't able to handle. So what we're trying to do now is to undo that part of it, give that responsibility back to us so that we can do it when we have the machinery in place and the expertise in place to do that. And this will, in effect, give us statutory authority to do what we had worked out through an informal process as being the best result.
Questions from the committee? Thank you. And we will recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 162 and go to a public hearing on... what is that bill number?
487.
Oh, Senate Bill 487. I thought that's the one we weren't going to hear. Okay. Public hearing on Senate Bill 487. Representative, senators. I just warned the committee to brace for impact. You want me to say welcome? Welcome, Senator Adams.
Thank you.
Representative, Senator Courtney.
I would like, Mr. Chair, as the Senate be sentimental reasons as y'all develop, a few seconds to speak, and then I'm very pleased to be long time coach and teacher, championship coach and teacher at McNary High School, and also this joint district. I ask
was the President of the Senate invited personally by you, Senator Courtney?
He was.
You're going to explore, are you going to explore that? I mean, I'm sure that the committee is curious.
Yes, we'll explore it. It will become very obvious.
There's some young men and women here that have come from a school to observe, so I know that we're going to be, all of us, on our best behavior. And so, okay. Senator.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Brady Adams. I'm a state senator representing District 25, and I am pleased to come to you today in regards to the bill that you have before you. For me, it's a very simple situation, and that is that we need to be able to provide incentives for our children to stay in school, and I believe that this bill will cause that to happen. No matter how much money we spend, no matter how good a quality program we have, if kids aren't in school, it doesn't make any difference. When you are young, and I can attest to this myself, a car is a powerful incentive. It is something that, in my own particular personal case, consumed a lot of my attention and time, and I do know that if attendance was an issue in regards to my ability to be able to drive, it would have been another motivator for me to stay in school. I think it's just that simple, that this is a way for us to be able to help kids stay in school. I want to make one comment in regards to Senator Thornton. Part of that came back, Representative Backlund was my U.S. history teacher at North Salem High School when he first started out. And I wasn't the world's best student. I think my attendance was reasonably low. I don't remember that exactly. I did get suspended one time. I was kind of interesting. I skipped school one time, and they suspended me for skipping school. And I could never quite figure that logic out. If you skip school, you get to get a little bit more time off, which was what you were trying to do in the first place. So there is a another North Salem linkage there. But that's it. I just think this is an opportunity for us to help kids stay in school.
Questions from the committee? Senator Adams? Representative Backlund?
Very good. Thank you, Chair Censeri and members of the committee. I feel very privileged to be at the table with Senate President Adams. It's true. He was in my very first U.S. history class. It was an advanced class, I must say, college preparatory class. And Senator Adams reminded me that he wasn't the world's best student, but he liked the class. And I was very pleased to hear that. So I am Vic Backlund. I am a representative from District 33, which is North Salem and Kaiser. And prior to becoming a representative, I was a high school teacher for 37 years in the Salem-Kaiser School District and the last 33 in McNary. And I, counting my coaching days, I probably came into direct contact with perhaps 9,000 students. Over that 37-year period. And it is interesting to reflect on how important a driver's license is to high school kids. Maybe we can't even estimate how important it is. And I think that in our current mode of Reform Education Act, the emphasis on standards, on passing the STEM, those kinds of things, we need to do what we can to really motivate kids to come to school. And so I think this bill would do that because it ties everything to the driver's license. And for kids ages 15 until just short of their 18th birthday. And so it's a very powerful bill because it reaches kids where kids are most concerned, I think, and that is their driver's license. I've seen a lot of kids over the years change priorities when they got a car, and they had to support that car, and so their emphasis or their points of emphases became work, and school became a bit less important, and a good number of those kids ended up not doing very well in high school. This bill, I think, would make a lot of corrections to solve a good number of our attendance problems, and so I'm very much in support of this bill. And I compliment Senator Courtney for pushing it, and I think it's a step in the right direction. Thank you.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I commend you for bringing this bill forward. I did note, though, Representative Jackson, that one of your students from your district complained that it may have an impact on them getting sued from a job. Would you care to comment on that?
Chair Censeri and Representative Winters, to me, if you look at the age group, ages 15 to just short of 18, these kids should be in school. I believe their number one priority at that point in their lives is school and not the job. And I think if they do work, there are other ways to get to work, such as carpool, such as city buses and that kind of thing. So I think a lot of it's a matter of priorities. I also think if we challenge students, they will do better than we may believe they can do. And so, again, that's one reason why I like this bill.
Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chair, the reason I appeal to Courtney State Senator 17, asked the President to be here is we discussed this bill before the session began because they major player at North Salem High School had come to me and said, Peter, you got to do something about the dropout rate in our high schools. And I looked at 24J, particularly at North and some of the schools around here, and they had an astronomically high, particularly the dropout rate. He is a graduate of North Salem High School, so we were going to introduce this bill together. But I've learned over the years, sometimes it's better not to put your name on a bill, but but to have it introduced as a committee bill. And so that's what I did on this, to introduce the Judiciary Committee. You should also know that the gentleman who just rushed out of here, and I wish he hadn't, introduced House Bill 3156, some of you signed on to, which would have done the same thing. But the Representative Backlund went a step further, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. He went a step further than this bill did. What's so remarkable is we were working this bill in the Senate Education Committee. The Department of Education for the state of Oregon released statistics that one out of four kids that enter the ninth grade will not graduate from an Oregon high school. If you go back to last June, almost 11,000 kids that should have graduated didn't graduate because they dropped out. Furthermore, we know that once you see truancy rates, it's like a gateway to dropout. You should also look at juvenile crime figures, and you'll find that juvenile crime figures are the greatest between 8 o'clock in the morning and 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon during weekdays. There's even that correlation and that connection. This became such a problem in the nation that 19 states already have this law, and when they go even a step further. The 19 states are interesting because we all have images of different states, and I know about a lot of these states because I lived in the state that pioneered this. I was raised in the state that pioneered this. If you haven't seen October Sky, I invite you to do it. West by God, Virginia. West Virginia, which has one of the poorest public school systems in the nation, pioneered this in 1987, and it had a dramatic effect in turning things around. Alabama, Arkansas, California, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Minnesota, Mississippi, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. I think if you just rush through those, you'll see we have the gamut of states in terms of your image, whether liberal or conservative or whatever, that have adopted this kind of law. But the law that we have here that you adopt is rather novel, because the bill, the way we drafted it, would say that in order for you to get your driver's permit and driver's license, that is mandatory in terms of showing you're involved in a GED program, homeschooling, private school, or in some kind of public education scenario. However, once you have the driver's license, then school boards across the state will be allowed the discretion to decide whether or not they want to adopt the program to suspend your license if you miss 10 consecutive days or 15 days in a term. We do not mandate it. Why don't we mandate it? The reason we don't mandate is I have attached to your testimony the absentee rate of some of your high school. I have here a compilation of every single high school and the dropout rate in the state of Oregon. It's fascinating. I only chose the high schools that were double digits because many high schools, your information members, do not have a dropout rate, but other high schools are as high as 15 to 16%. And so their school boards may decide we want to adopt this program to put kids on notice that if you're not coming to school, we have the right to notify the Motor Vehicles Division, which will suspend your license. Now, both COSA and the school boards support this bill. They'll be here later to testify on it. Also, the Motor Vehicles Division, which initially had opposed it, they have come around to go neutral and not oppose the bill. This bill will not solve all the problems. What's interesting, some of the states that I noted, as well as Mr. Backlund's bill that you signed on to, he not only tied it to absenteeism and being a dropout, he tried it to grade point average. And many of the 19 states that I just spoke to you about, as well as five other states in the nation, have legislation will tie it not only to not coming to school, but to your GPA. Many schools, as you know now, tie athletics to your GPA. I chose not to do that for a lot of reasons, although I'm not opposed to it. But it was interesting. Here's an individual who spent 37 years at McNary High School, and before that at your alma mater at North Salem. He not only wanted it for dropout, he wanted it for GPA. So, will it solve all the problems? No. But it's interesting, when I carried this bill on the floor, you ought to have heard what the pages have said, one of whom is right here now, sitting right there, Mr. Crane, Stephen Crane, who graduated from McKay High School. You know what his comment was? Geez, I hate this bill. I hate this bill. Because if this bill had been in effect when I was in McKay High School, I couldn't have gone out and fooled around as much as I did. I included letters here from students, many students who say how they feel about it. A number of students have admitted to me privately, I hate you, Peter. I hate you, Mr. Courtney, because if this becomes law in 24J, because I have five 4A high schools in Salem. There are five Salem and 4A high school in the Salem-Kaiser area. It's going to affect whether or not I, in effect, behave myself. Some of the most compelling testimony given for the Senate Education Committee was by an intern, Senator A.V.L. Gordley, during spring break who came down. He'd just gotten his permit, and he said, well, I'll tell you this much. I just now have gotten my car. My parents are going to let me have a car. And I got to tell you, this bill is going to affect me because I notice that I go to school late in the morning because I figure I'll wake up late and I can get there. I never get there on time because I got a car. and I have an open campus. He goes to Grand High School, and I can leave, and I'm getting back late for my school hour because I got my own car. So not, there's those kids that don't have a car that I think it affects. But many kids today have cars. When I talked to the Glencoe student editor, she said, I don't know what we're going to do up here at Glencoe, because I'll tell you, half the kids we never see after the noon hour. There's so many cars and things. I think it can be used as a carrot or a stick. I think it's a unique approach we're using, both in terms of Oregon. And I ask that you seriously consider this as a positive vote. And as I say, I think you can see it has bipartisan support, as well as support already from the House side in terms of, and it's none of that, the House wants to go a step even further than we did in the Senate. So I know I talk quick and I talk fast. I know you have a very busy schedule, what, six, I don't know how many bills up today. So I want to honor that, Mr. Chair. And I really thank you for taking us out of order and allowing us to come here today to present Senate Bill 487.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I commend you, gentlemen, for trying to do something about the dropout rate. It's obviously a problem. However, when I explained this to my 15-year-old daughter, what this bill did, she was outraged because she saw it as a loss of liberty, a loss of freedom, and an increase in government regulation and control. And that's my concern with this bill. You know, we have an economic system today that has everybody working and full employment almost. But I'm thinking my father during the Depression, when he had to travel with his father as a contractor, they had to go where the jobs were. He wasn't always able to go to school. He had to work. And he always told the story that he was 19 in the ninth grade because that's when he was able to go to school. I just see this, you know, as working today, but in another economy, I'm not so sure. So maybe you could address my concerns.
Thank you. And I should have covered that, and I didn't, Representative Close. If you read this bill on the front page, in the back, there has to be an appeal process. And in the appeal process, the student can make known the fact that they need to work or they're involved in an alternative education program. We have in here just about every conceivable thing, the GED program, work, all kinds of things, which a student could bring forward and say, look, I can be here so many hours, then I need to be at work, then I need to do GED. We put that in this bill for the very reasons, Representative Close, that you talked about. One size does not fit all, and that's basically what you're saying, and I want to honor that. Not every kid, for all kinds of reasons, can go to high school from, 8 o'clock in the morning to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I think the good president would agree with me that. He tried to reflect that with the flexibility of this in here, as well as the appeal process. So I think I've tried to acknowledge your very good concerns about the fact that kids, there's all kinds of kids. They have different lifestyles. Some have to work, and some high school just doesn't work. They got a GED. There's homeschoolers. There's public-private schools. I think if you read it, we've tried very, very hard not to be overly bearing or overly arbitrary and say it's only either you do it this way or else. So we tried to do that, Representative Close. And maybe, I don't know. We tried.
Thank you.
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, too, for bringing this bill forward. The question I have is don't we get to the problem? The basic problem with Section 6, Paragraph 38, which basically allows the school district to notify the Department of Transportation if a student is not in school without all of the requirements for the notice and the forms from prior to getting the driver's license. But once the driver's license is issued, it's in the back page, it's page 10. It seems to me that would be the least, it would address Representative Close's concerns as well, I believe, about the additional bureaucracy and paperwork that would be necessary.
Your question again, Representative Starr, I'm sorry.
It seems to me that this section appears to be the section where the school district can notify the Department of Transportation
right.
If a student is not in school. It seems to me that, and then they could have their driver's license suspended at that point. Seems to me that gets to the crux of the problem without the rest of the bill that deals with having to get a form, having to take it prior to getting your driver's license. Once a person has their license, the opportunity to have it suspended or taken away from them seems to be a pretty powerful incentive.
Yes.
And there is.
There is an appeal process, too, you know.
I guess my point is, do we need the rest of it if we have that one section? Do we need to have the sections 2 of the bill that deals with you know, the forms that you have to fill out, take with you to DMV?
You do, because Section 2 of the bill involves the mandatory across the state getting your license to begin with. Section 2 speaks to across the board, when you get your permit, you're going to get your license. You have to go and bring in a form, and Motor Vehicles Division has no problems with this. We worked it all through with them, a very simple form, which shows that you're enrolled and doing something in school. So you do need the form. They need that form on file. Now, as far as the suspension is concerned, that's going to be up to individual school boards whether or not they want to get into that part of the program. We're telling students before they get their license how serious we think it is for them to stay in school or be involved in some kind of alternative education program. We're telling them across the board. Once they get their license, Representative Starr, then it's going to be up to the school board whether or not they want to use, you know, if they've got an absentee problem, like in these high schools that I showed you. In that case, that's where you get into a situation where they simply would notify and take care of it along those lines, if you know what I mean. So there's two different programs in operation here, both of which have an appeal process, I might add, in case we have too much of a burden. Two different programs. As I say, when we started out Motor Vehicles Division, or perhaps some of the reasons Representative Close said, saw it as too much of a burden or too expensive. We worked with them, and then we came up with this approach so that all their objections, they don't have them now. In fact, they think this is very clean and very simple. And the 19 states that have this program, we call every single one of them. And this is more or less the way they work it. And they say it's very simple. The forms are very simple. It works very smoothly. It's having pretty good results. So,
Representative Morissette. Great bill should pass. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, welcome. Question that I would have is, say, in this example, a school chooses to go the suspension route, use that portion of the bill. With a young person who is under 18 years of age, who is potentially suspended or who is, in fact, arrested for driving suspended, will that young person be adjudicated any differently than, say, for instance, if Representative Canope were arrested for driving suspended?
Chair, sincerely, absolutely not. No. We're not putting anybody in jail. We're not adjudicating him. That their license is suspended for a semester, and in fact they can even have it the time cut shorter if they can bring in evidence they've gone back to school and things. So that's not what we're about here. This is between the school board or the school and the Motor Vehicles Division. It's not between the juvenile department or the juvenile court or juvenile authorities. It isn't that kind of suspension, if I may say so.
So then, if I may follow up, there's no penalty for that student, no monetary penalty, no appearing before the court, nothing like that, if they're suspended?
No, there's nothing appearing before the court. We don't even have a procedure setting up where they've got to go before Motor Vehicles Division and create some kind of administrative court there. Not at all. This is the school district and a high school and the Motor Vehicles Division, and that's it. That's as simple as we can make it, and that's all there is to this, Representative Wilson. This is not, the answer is absolutely, unequivocally, no.
Thank you.
Representative Winters?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think it's a good bill, and the motivation is good of wanting to reduce the dropout rate. I think there's another message in here also, and that's the message that driving is a privilege and it's not a right. And I think that message even some of us forget as adults, and maybe if the younger we learn that, maybe we won't do so many infractions as we get older. And I just want to make one comment. I think probably you and I are the only two relics still in 24J. I believe it's now Salem-Keizer School District, and you and I still say 24J. Just to say how long we've been around.
Well, Senator Clinton is a rep.
I know I'm the old master sergeant, but I've never been called a rep, I guess.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Courtney, you've talked about the other 19 states. What's the longest that any state has had this in existence?
Thank you. The state of West Virginia introduced it in 1987.
Okay. And you probably covered this in your testimony, but statistically, what has been the effect on their enrollment in the last 12 years?
It immediately turned around by one-third or higher percent. They noticed immediately the turnaround, and they've been able to hang in there with it, if you know what I mean. West Virginia has a lot of problems. I don't want to get into West Virginia too much because I say that affectionately, the chair, sincerely, Representative Benson, because, you know, it's part of who I am, believe it for better or worse. But they've been very satisfied with it because we personally talked with their officials. We didn't write to them. We talked to their officials. They had an immediate one-third or higher percentage turnaround in terms of their dropout rate. So they considered it to be a very positive thing. They were in desperate straits, and so they feel very good about it. Now, obviously, it doesn't make every kid come back. I want you to understand that. I'm not saying that every kid who drops out or is starting to show a problem is going to come back. That, you know, I didn't say that. But it has had a dramatic impact on the state of West Virginia, and they've been able to maintain that. They feel good about it.
Representative Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with Representative Winters on all fronts, including
the relic. Huh?
The relic. Senator Courtney, you said something that the school district's policy, what's going to be optional? Is that how they implement a certain part of it? Can you restate that?
I'm sorry. I'm not doing a very good job.
It's just been a while since I said it, so I forgot.
The school district, every school district will have an option to decide, if this becomes law, whether or not they want to adopt a dropout suspension of license program under this bill. They will make, the school board will make the decision. Your school board or boards up in Portland will make the decision. We are not mandating that on them, suspension. However, up the front end, where Representative Close's daughter is 15, so she's getting close to that learner's permit, getting her driver's license. The front end, it's not discretionary. Every kid in the state, when they go to get the final moment, you know, there's certain things the kids got to do. They got to pass a written test. They got to pass a driving test. The parents have got to sign a statement. I know because my oldest just got his this past July. They have got to go get a form that'll be available, that whether it's a GED, they can fill out a homeschool form. These forms will be made available by the Motor Vehicles Division to show that they are enrolled or are presently in school in order to get that initial license. There's no discretion there. The discretion is, once they get it, a school district can come in and say, hey, we have a dropout rate problem in our school district, and I tried to show you that with the attachment in terms of some of those high schools.
Done.
They've got some serious problems. Salem-Keizer has a serious problem. I would suggest my school district ought to look very seriously at adopting this program. So I hope I've made the distinction of what we're doing here.
And follow up. So you're a 16-year-old, and there's going to be a form at DMV. You've got to fill out it's a new form or new line on the existing form. Who verifies that? Is the district going to, do you have to go to the principal? Or so the principal of every school then will sign every kid's driver's license?
Which part? Which program?
On the front end.
Front end, correct.
Front end.
Or the
The principal, or is it a teacher?
Well, it'll be in the principal's office, or it'll be available in some form. The principal's office, the forms will be there, or the community college or motor vehicles division will have the forms, as we discussed it, and it'll be a very simple form, too, so it can be verified. That's right.
Okay.
I mean, if you have a homeschool situation in motor vehicles division, whereas you can have a private school or GED or a public school, then it'll be available from those schools.
One final question. So on the optional part of it, once the kid's got his license, has gone through the initial step, then districts can decide if kids are truant, inclined. The district could or may not have a policy on whether to get rid of the kid's license, right?
Correct.
Are you concerned of that inconsistency between school districts being a problem that people are saying, hey, how come my friend who goes to Staten didn't knock his license out, but my district, Salem-Keizer's, took my license away? It's not fair. What kind of problem have you anticipated, whether there be problems associated with inconsistency?
Chair Sinceri, Representative Beck, I don't, first of all, consider it inconsistency. I think school districts, we believe in local control in the state to a large extent, and school districts have different programs, different approaches. Some have year-round schools. Some don't meet on Fridays, like out here at Perrydale and some other schools, and we allow for that. This will be another example where a school district, in order, will look at its students and see what they have, and if they want to take advantage of this program, they can. I might as well tell all of you that if you look at the other 19 states, whatever reason, it's my understanding, they mandated across the board. We looked at this and decided that rather than start with that approach, we would leave it up to local control and the school district, which knows its students and its teachers best, and let them make that decision. And I don't think it's inconsistent, and we've already checked the constitutionality out to legislative council, and they have reviewed it and feel that it's constitutionally sound as well.
Representative, thank you, Chair Sincere. I was just going to ask you the fiscal impact in terms of DMV services, and then I have another question. But
DMV is here. It's my understanding, actually, I shouldn't say this, the files will show, if you haven't, if your committee administrator doesn't have it, it depends upon how many school districts are involved, but if only 25% were involved, it's my understanding that the state, it's even, and then if more school districts are involved, and I'm rushing through my materials here, actually the state, I don't like to use the phrase makes money, but they actually come out ahead because when the student files his application to get his license reinstated, he or she has to pay for that. So in terms of revenue, it's revenue neutral. It's not costing the state. Again, the Motor Vehicles Division person is here and can explain to you that situation because we carefully went over that as well. We were concerned about the cost of it.
Oh, and finally, an important question. Is your neckwear today with a juvenile misfit on it? Is that coincidence or... did you plan that today?
Self-portrait.
What do you see?
We got Bart Simpson on there. Why?
Juvenile. What was your exact statement about me?
Juvenile misfit.
Juvenile misfit.
Your neckwear, yes.
I just grabbed it. I wasn't trying to make a statement. I just grabbed it. It was raining out. Yellow's pretty. It's spring. I just grabbed it. My kids asked. Actually got me this tie, which maybe says something to use about my kid. They're not bad. And so every so often I like to wear it because they like me to wear it. So that's how it happened. You know what I mean? One of those things.
Vincent Van Gogh used to paint self-portraits. Senator Courtney likes to wear self-portraits.
I have a lot of ties. I know the kind of ties I wear.
I know.
And I could have worn another... which would have also been as sensational as this or outrageous, but I don't know. I just wore it.
I thought it was a poster child for this.
Is that what you said?
Representative Winters.
I have not a poster child question, but one that deals with insurance. If what kind of impact would this have if the youngster was suspended and then was reinstated? What would that do to... their insurance premiums?
Representative Winters, we didn't discuss that. I don't have an answer. It did not come up in our committee. I don't have an answer.
I'm the only fiscal person that thinks about the insurance implication for parents.
Well, as I say, I would think personally, this Peter thing, that since it didn't involve an accident or something like that, if you know what I mean, it would be neutral because that's where your insurance rates are going to happen. As long as you weren't, if you're suspended because you're not going to school, I would think. I'm not saying I'm certified smart on that. That's what I would think. But I don't want you to rely on that at this stage of the game. So I try to qualify my statement and try to speculate.
Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Winters has a excellent point that we need to consider before we move ahead with this bill because we need to know what the implications are going to be on the insurance and how much more it's going to cost for Senator Courtney for his son's insurance on his cars if, in fact, that situation were to appear in his home. I have some real reservations about what happens when a license is revoked or taken away and what the implication is going to be with insurance. And perhaps we need to talk to them, the insurance companies, about how we might be able to deal with this.
Something we can pursue.
Again,
pursue that.
Chair Sincere, Representative Denson, to me the bottom line was here that one out of four Oregon kids are not finishing school. That's pretty serious stuff. We 11,000 as of last June, and I believe you to be action students and how much they want their driver's license, want to keep it. That was our bottom line, and maybe you, I think you're right to get into the insurance discussion, but I hope that the bottom line is we got to keep them in school, and if this will keep a certain percentage, a good percentage, then we got to take advantage of this.
Mr. Chair and Representative Jensen, that might actually be another motivator. I can just think of my own particular situation that if my children were not at school enough to get themselves in this situation, I have some responsibility for that as their parent. And if there was an additional fiscal cost, not that I know that there is, and I'm not sure that there would be, that might be additional motivation to make sure from my standpoint that I keep my kids in that school. And I think that gets down to the bottom line again, is that I don't know if there is a cost or not, but part of the solution comes in this. Part of it gets family. That might just be another way to get families' attention if they're out there skipping school.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senators, at least for Representative Jensen, I wasn't suggesting that we not move ahead with this. I was merely suggesting that this is something that I think we need to investigate so we know what we're doing.
Right. Well, this committee is getting a reputation for far and wide for ever pursuing the truth. Relentless pursuit. So in the cause of pursuing truth, we will have Mr. Crane come and talk to us, who's the one who hates the bill. And no more. Senators are welcome to wait, to stand by and listen to the.
Really, thank you for taking us first. I think we're the last you're going to take, so I really appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for all your questions.
Hey, Senator Courtney, could you give this young man your tie, please?
My name is Steve Crane. For the record, I'm a Senate page, and when I'm not doing that, I coach Little League Baseball in the Kaiser Little Leagues. The age group I coach, they're 14, 15, and 16-year-olds, and so this bill is aimed right at them, and they despise it. I hear about it every day at practice. They say, down at the Capitol, you got to do something about that bill, that, you know, we're going to have to start going to class so that we can drive. From what I understand from Senator Courtney, that's the idea, is to get them in class. So, that.
Well, if they went to class, they wouldn't be in jeopardy.
Exactly.
Representative Close.
Maybe I could ask you a question then. I have read that the number one reason for students dropping out is irrelevant coursework. Should people be made to sit through irrelevant coursework, in your opinion?
Well, I also went to school to be a school teacher, so I don't consider a lot of school irrelevant. Projects when I was in high school that I thought were stupid and didn't want to do, later on I learned they taught me things like time management and other skills that, even though it didn't really, learning about Roman this or Roman that didn't matter, but learning how to learn was the whole idea.
Representative Hobbs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think it's been too long since you were in the category and the age limit that we're talking about. And if you would reflect back to when you were in high school and the kids who were dropping out, many of whom you no doubt knew, who were in classes one day and not the next, do you think this would really help the dropout rate?
I think it would, in that at least one of my friends who didn't graduate right away with us, he actually had to spend an extra year in school. As soon as he got his car, he could go to Portland. He could just disappear for days. And because of that, he started failing classes. And his parents actually got on him, so he turned around and finished school. But other kids would have, once you get behind, they just quit.
My follow-up, thank you, Mr. Chair, was going to be, why didn't his parents do something about
that? They did. It was the other kids' parents didn't.
So for a young man who hates the bill, you're certainly supportive.
I told Senator Courtney I hated the bill. I would have hated it when I was in high school, but now I can see its value.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Taylor or Mr. Green? We're not getting Mr. Taylor. Oh, I'm sorry.
Members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association. We do support the bill. We did a floor letter on the Senate side with regard to this, and we see it as an ability to address an issue that's real out there. In 1997-1998, Oregon's high school dropout rate on average was 6.9%. And we see this as giving us tools in order to address that. There is one comment I would like to make about the first part of the bill. I think it gets to Representative Starr's question. I don't think you can just leave that last section there on page 10 without the other parts of the bill, because withdraw would also mean a student who would withdraw for homeschooling. You need that exemption in there for students who withdraw from the public schools to go to private schools or homeschools, or who go get their GED or drop out, may drop out for a variety of reasons. We support the bill, one, because it's not a mandate to us in the second part of the bill. We worked with Senator Courtney on this to make sure that it was up to each local school district, working with their parents, working with their students, working with their patrons as to if it's something they truly want to do. We have a similar provision in law currently that was passed in the 1995 session that says if a student brings a weapon to get a weapon to school, school districts may adopt a policy that says that we can apply to the Department of Transportation, Division of Motor Vehicles, to withdraw the student's driving privileges. We have had some students across the state who have brought weapons, and weapons is very broadly defined, more broad than just guns or shotguns or rifles, but a variety of weapons out there. And if they do bring a weapon to school, we have that ability now at the local district level by a district-by-district basis to make that request to withdraw their driving privileges. The state has said that's a big enough issue that we should take away a privilege that a student has. And driving is a very big privilege. I have a niece who is just getting ready to get her driver's license, and when I told her about this bill, she said, oh my God, that means now I can't go out to lunch with my friends and be a class late to come back from lunch. And I said, Deanna, that's exactly what it means. If your school districts adopt this policy, that means you're going to have to be back to school when your lunch hour is over and back in class and studying. But that's up to her local school district as to whether they're going to implement that policy or not. We like the front end because the form that's going to be provided to us by DMV that the principal or his or her designee will sign off on. We do have some buildings that are large. Principals are very busy, but they can designate someone in that office to be the person that has to sign off on this. So it's just that additional form the student has to bring with them. We see it as a way to address the dropout rate. Because we do see driving privileges, we hear from students across the state that it is a rite of passage for them, and to keep that driver's license is very important to a lot of students across the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your discussion with the boards around the state, what kind of feel or input did you get of how many would utilize this provision once implemented?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winters, in discussing it with our policy folks, because they're the ones that go out and help the school districts develop this policy, when we passed the act in 1995 with regard to weapons, a lot of our school districts, of the 100, well, there were over 198, and I believe well over 60% actually adopted the policy. It's still at their local discretion as to whether they're going to submit that form to request the privileges be withdrawn. But when we put this in our newsletter that went out, in the Legislative Highlight newsletter that went out, I received about 40 calls that following Tuesday from school boards saying, when can we do this? So I think that school districts are going to be looking at this as a tool. I think the information that Senator Courtney handed out to you, when you see those dropout rates, and the reason for dropouts vary from I've got to go to work, which we would allow an exemption for, to I'm not being challenged enough because I'm talented and gifted and the classes don't challenge me enough, or I just want to drop out, I don't want to be in school anymore. We can address those issues through this. And remember, there is that due process right built into this, so that if they are going to request for withdrawal from school and their privileges are going to be suspended, that school district is going to work with those parents and that kid to make sure that they can either work things out or they will make that request for withdrawal.
Representative Close.
Mr. Green, would you direct me to that exemption clause? I'm having trouble locating the exemption for work.
Section 2, paragraph 7, or page 2, sorry.
Yes, that is. Okay. Ms. Chair, Representative Close, it's on page 2. The top part provides the department with documentation satisfactory to the department that indicates that the person is exempted from school attendance requirements due to circumstances beyond the control of the person.
So that's supposed to apply to work. Is that what you're saying?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Post, it may apply to that. It may apply to a broad variety of things beyond work.
So if they choose to work, is that beyond their control or not?
Well, I believe, Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, I think you have to look at each individual situation as to why they want to go to work. Do they need to go to work to help their family, you know, because their parents are ill or their grandparents are ill and they need to help out with expenses around the house, which I believe we have programs around the state that can address certain needs, educational needs for those students, versus I want to go to work and make money so I can have a car, or I want to make money so I can take my girlfriend or my boyfriend out on the weekends. That's a very different circumstance than what could be there. And we left that purposely broad to address each individual based on each individual circumstance.
Thank you.
I apologize again.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Cater with the Department of Transportation. And just briefly, you've heard different pieces of the bill. I just want to walk through and I want to clarify a little of some of the questions I heard just from my own experience. It is true that up front, to get your driver's license at the motor vehicles, you'd have to provide some sort of documentation that either you've graduated or you're in some sort of either high school or private school or home school or college or something continuing your education. One of those things would have to be met. And the piece that Representative Close was just talking about is or providing us with some sort of documentation that shows us that due to circumstances beyond your control. And quite frankly, we haven't defined that yet. We'll have to figure that out so that we think we're meeting the intent. My guess is I'd probably be by rule. And then on the flip side of it, high school principals can choose in their school districts can choose to adopt the policy for the public high schools to withdraw a student's driving privileges, have us suspend them, either till they're 18 or till they go back into school. Now, Mr. Chair, Representative Wilson asked a question, and Wilson, I thought I got a little different question. Were you asking what would happen if somebody were suspended and they got stopped, what the penalty would be for that for driving while suspended? That seemed to me what you were asking, but I wasn't sure.
That's not exactly what I asked, but that's what I meant.
Okay. Yeah. Well then, Mr. Chair, may I answer?
Yes, please.
This would be a driving while suspended violation. You would be suspended like other violations, although it probably would not be a misdemeanor or felony like some of the DUIs or some of the murder manslaughter type charges. But you would be driving while suspended. And so the car would be subject to being towed, because anybody driving while suspended, a car can be towed. And you would be subject to a ticket and a citation and going to court and a fine. And that would be, if you were found guilty, you would be placed on your record. And driving while suspended is one of the convictions that adds towards a habitual offender, although I don't know if the infraction level does. So I just wanted to clarify that because I thought that's where you're asking.
So it would have the same impact on insurance as well.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Now, as far as once it's reinstated, which is what I thought I heard Representative Winters asking, is, okay, so what if my license were suspended and then reinstated, what would happen? Well, obviously, while you're suspended, your insurance would not be in effect. So it'd be like anybody, if they're driving while suspended, insurance isn't going to cover that car if they are in a wreck or something. So you've got a bigger problem there. But once reinstated, I'm not sure what the insurance companies would do with it. It would be information they would have access to, just like any other reinstated suspension. But I'm not sure whether they would count that as they would a conviction or an accident. And I can't speak to the insurance industry, but I wanted to say, if you were driving while suspended, your insurance would not be covering you at that point. As far as the impact of the department and the fiscal, there is a minimum, a minimum cost just to build the new suspension type and the process associated in the forms, and that we've estimated to be $64,600, and that covers both the information system changes and the forms that we've all been talking about being able to provide. Now, trying to figure out, okay, once you've built it, how many will come is the difficult part. And so what we did in the fiscal was we did a range of 25 or 50 or 100% based on the numbers provided from all the different school districts that we were in contact with. And it would range, you know, if it were somewhere around 25%, then it would probably be around one FTE type of an impact. If it were up to 100%, then it would be around four FTE. So the minimum is $64,600. That's just to do the programming and order the forms. And then it's kind of a wait and see depending on, you know, how many schools actually adopt the policy, and then having the policy, then how many actually use the policy. So I think that's about all. I was trying to think if there were any other questions I could remember. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your computation, was there any attempt to do an offset of fees generated when they were reinstated?
Mr. Chair and Reverend Winters, yes. Again, going from a 25 to 100%, in the first biennium at a 25% level, the revenues would not quite cover the cost because there's some one-time cost for the programming stuff in the first biennium. But in subsequent bienniums, no matter whether you're at 25% or 100%, there are more revenues collected for, it's a $53 reinstatement fee, than there are expenditures. But there would be some FTE that we'd either have to absorb or would have to be provided, one or the other.
But the $53 collected for reinstatement would probably balance the FTE fees?
If Mr. Chair and Reverend Winters, if the FTE were granted, yes, they would cover their costs.
Thank you.
Ozzie?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. We opposed the bill that was introduced. We supported it as it's been amended. There is evidence in some states that do this sort of thing that it does impact school attendance. I'm not sure how it does everything that it is touted to do, except I do know it places the issue of getting a driver's license at a higher level of responsibility, importance, or whatever. It helps make that important. And I think that has some impact on some other issues about students driving and so forth. I don't think that Mr. Green's niece would lose her driver's license for coming back late because it takes 15 days of unexcused absence per semester. And I don't think an hour every so often or even every day would add up to that. That's a sidelight, by the way. But I think the bill is worth pursuing and encourage you to move it out.
Thank you. Anyone else wanted to testify on this bill that didn't get to sign up? Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 487, and we will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 152. Mr. Roberts, have you got anything more you wanted to add to this?
No.
Okay, Grant, Karen.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Jackie Cairns representing the Oregon University System. Senate Bill 162 is, while not housekeeping, is a catch-up that affects the Higher Education Efficiency Act, which was Senate Bill 271, passed in the 1995 legislative session, in which the authority for the university system over personnel, purchasing, contracting, printing, and a lot of the other administrative duties of the university campuses were granted by that bill, 271, to the State Board of Higher Education, including a significant number of efficiencies. You recently received in your offices a report by the review panel on Senate Bill 271 addressing those changes. Senate Bill 162 was introduced at the request of the university system in consultation with the Bureau of Labor and Industries and others regarding the effect of 271 and the prevailing wage statute. We added back a number of the sections which had been taken out by 271, as the commissioner said, regarding enforcement, and at their request. We had no experience of a negative kind in administration of the statute. We have a fairly sophisticated capital construction team at the university system and on the campuses and are well-versed in these matters, but we thought for purposes of going forward to respond to the Bureau's inquiries regarding those enforcement questions, we would introduce this bill you have in front of us. He was A, engrossed in the Senate committee to catch up one other item, which we have not put in our bill. We agreed to it. The bill came from the Senate Education Committee unanimously, passed the floor of the Senate unanimously, and has no opposition from the Bureau or any other party that I'm aware of.
Questions? Representative Winters.
It has all these ORSs in it and doesn't have much language yet, and I'm assuming that it was quite a knotty problem for the university at the time you were trying to implement it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winters, no, actually what the bill did was gave the State Board of Higher Education the authority by rule to carry forward these statutory obligations. And as I said, we've had a long experience in capital construction and public works. They did adopt by rule a set of amendments to our OARs and carried forward. Did not experience problems with that in 95-97 biennium and coming into this biennium. Instead, what in reviewing the statute under the 271 review panel process, others who were affected, such as the Bureau, also did their own review and came forward. We had discussions with them and said, for purposes of administration, yes, we can grant. We'll grant back through this statute those enforcement powers, still retaining for the university system virtually all of the other administrative rules governing these capital construction projects. So we didn't have a problem, nor did the Bureau, but looking forward, they felt, and we agreed, that the enforcement portion should be revested in the Bureau.
Thank you, Brent. Anybody else wanted to testify on 162? We will move into a work session on Senate Bill 162.
I move Senate Bill 162 to the floor with the due pass. The Ian Gross Senate Bill 162.
Representative Winters moves Senate Bill 162 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Green.
Senate Beck.
Aye.
Representative
Yes.
Representative
Jensen. Aye.
Representative
Knope? Aye.
Representative
Morissette? Excuse.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Winters?
Aye.
Representative Serres?
Okay, motion is adopted. Representative Beck, would you like to carry that bill?
Sure, why not?
We will close the work session on Senate Bill 162, and we will open public hearing on Senate Bill 711. Ms. Kirkwood, Ms. Christensen. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Phyllis Kirkwood, a substitute teacher in Beaverton and president of the Oregon Substitute Teachers Association.
Good morning, good afternoon, Chairman and representatives. I'm Yvonne Christensen. I'm a substitute teacher in Clackamas County.
This afternoon, we're bringing Senate Bill 711 as amended on the Senate side. And we really thank you, Representative Sinceri and committee, for hearing this bill in so quickly. This bill has to do with our access to lists of substitute teachers' names and addresses, which is very important for our association, since there's a large turnover each year of substitute teachers. And we like to be able to invite the substitute teachers of the state to our fall meeting, which has speakers relating to education and specific topics having to do with substitute teaching, as well as announcements about certification PERS and other items of interest to substitute teachers. Prior to 1997, we relied on the court case in 1981 of the Oregon Court of Appeals, and this was Morris versus School District 48. The result of that court case was that substitute teachers' names and addresses were public information. And one of the arguments in that case was that substitute teachers don't bring their addresses and phone numbers to be held secret. They do want those to be disclosed to school districts so that they can be hired for jobs and so that the paychecks can be sent to their homes. Substitute teachers don't have a workplace address. And this is one of the main problems. The only way of contacting the substitute teachers is by a phone call or a mailing to their home. And as I said, we only do the one mailing a year. If at the time of our conference the substitute teacher joins our association, then we send them other mailings with newsletters, announcements about legislation, and so forth. We explored other possibilities for getting the list from the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, which licenses the teachers. But the problem there is we all have regular certificates. Most of us have the certificates where we could be teaching full time. There are substitute teacher certificates, but most of us just have the regular certificates. And TSPC doesn't know how we're using our certificates. So that's not a way to be able to contact just substitute teachers. Then we tried to contact other teacher organizations such as Oregon math teachers, Oregon science teachers, to see if they also were having trouble getting their list. We found that mostly they used workplace addresses. And so we had originally brought language which would have said that a professional association could obtain lists of people in their profession. Senator Bryant and Senator Brown felt that this should be narrowed considerably and that it should apply only to the substitute teacher defined in the law, which is a teacher who substitutes for another teacher. So in that way, other teachers who can be contacted in other ways would still have their privacy protected. This passed the Senate 28-1. Do you have any questions?
I don't know if there's any questions. I suppose one question that might come up, is there any way at all that divulging this information, it could get into the wrong hands? You want this information to be made available.
We don't give it to anyone.
Okay, so there's no sale of lists or...
No.
Privacy of individuals won't be compromised in any way. Very good. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll move to a work session on Senate Bill 711. Representative Starr.
We move Senate Bill 711A to the House, to the floor of the House to do pass recommendations.
Senator Starr. Representative Starr moves Senate Bill 711 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? We'll call the roll.
Representative Beck.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative Hoffman.
Yes.
Representative Simpson.
Aye.
Representative Snow.
Aye.
Representative Worthat.
Aye.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Richards.
Excuse. Votes aye. Motion is adopted. Representative Thompson, would you carry that bill?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Close the public work session on Senate Bill 711. Here's the one you have. Oh, there it is. Okay. We will go into a public hearing on Senate Bill 167. Brett? Anybody else?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brett West from the Office of Community College Services. Excuse me, I'll try and be brief here so that my voice holds out. We introduced Senate Bill 167 prior to the beginning of the session to allow Klamath Community College the same local decision-making process for people of the districts that all other community colleges have. And that is, we wanted to extend the authority for the college to ask the voters in the area to incur bonded debt. Last session, we introduced a bill that extended it to all other community colleges except for Klamath because of the newness, I guess if that's a word, of the district. And so we wanted to come back this time and make sure that Klamath has the same authority that other community colleges in the state do. The one other thing that's retained in this bill is that there is a date after which a community college district would be formed. They would have to live by the current rules that Klamath does, and that is if they were formed after July 1st of 97, we would like to continue the prohibition of them being able to ask the voters for authority. And the reason for that is that we don't want any fly-by-night colleges set up. We believe that there is some value in having some protection in statute so that we don't incur debt and run away. Klamath Community College has become part of the fabric of the community down there, and we believe that they have done great work and deserve to be given the authority to ask their voters to incur debt. With that, I'll close and ask that you vote for the bill.
I'm appalled. Isn't that where the majority leader's from?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what kind of deal we could work out here. There's some opportunity here. Any questions? Thank you, Brad. Vicki Totten.
Chair Sinceri, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Totten, Oregon Community College Association. I just wanted to make sure that the association was on record in support of this bill, the last college to get bonding authority. And the deputy commissioner mentioned they'd made great strides. They're quickly working toward accreditation as a full-blown district, and they've done a lot of good work down there, and they ought to have the same ability every other college does to go to their public and ask them for support for capital projects.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We will go into a work session on Senate Bill 167. Senator Farr.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 167 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Starr moves Senate Bill 167 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Call the roll.
Representative
Beck. Aye.
Representative
Close.
Aye. Representative
Hopkins. Yes. Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Moore. Aye.
Representative
Starr. Aye.
Representative
Wilson. Aye. Representative Winters.
Excuse.
Representative
Harris. Votes aye. Motion is adopted. Representative Jensen, would you carry that bill?
Sure.
Close the discussion on Senate Bill 167, and we will go into a public hearing on Senate Bill 161. Congrats.
Mr. Chairman, a member of the committee for the record, Grant Insurance, representing the Oregon University System. Senate Bill 161 was introduced at the request of the Oregon University System. Permit the university system to do two things. One, distribute the responsibilities for the execution of payroll to the campuses from the systems controller housed in Corvallis, and two, allow the campuses to go to an other than once a month payroll system. very straightforward matter that came from the Senate committee unanimously, unanimous vote on the floor, and does not have opposition at any point that we've identified. The system in recent years has completed the implementation of its Human Resource Information System, HRIS, and Financial Information System, FIS, and is year 2000 ready as a result of these implementations, and is has the ability and wishes to devolve the payroll authority to campuses with, of course, a post-issuance review by the controller and under the authority which we retain for our own internal auditor, so that the system can have that function occur on the campus and that the campuses can have the flexibility the bill would permit. Very straightforward.
Questions? Then we'll move into a work session on Senate Bill 161. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move over today. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 161 to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Wilson moves Senate Bill 161 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, I have a note in my bill folder from one group that opposed this. I wondered if nobody signed up or no.
Only one person signed up. Is there anyone else that wanted to speak on this bill?
If they don't show up, I have to kind of ignore them.
Grattan, could you give us the disadvantages of this? Just
killing to it.
Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Beck.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative Hoffman.
Yes.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Nope.
Aye.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative
Winters.
Aye.
Chairman Carey. Well, it's aye. Well, it's adopted. Representative Close, would you carry that bill?
Sure.
We will close the work session on Senate Bill. So
that was 161.
161, and we went to a public hearing on Senate Bill 367. Trish and Greg Ferdo.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For your record, Greg McMurdo from the Department of Education. Senate Bill 367 really accomplishes three things. It will align the standard of the standardization process of education service districts to that that exists at K-12 education schools. In doing so, it would also create a definition of conditionally standard for those districts who are not standard districts, but we believe make substantial efforts toward being a standard district. Again, that's the same as we currently do for K-12 education districts. Further, the bill would include education service districts in a definition that would allow, that would require and permit the Department of Education to check the fingerprints of their classified employees. Last session, there was an amendment to the ESD law that created a situation where we have some ESDs who are covered now by the fingerprint law and some who are not covered, depending on whether or not they levy taxes and distribute those to their component school districts. This would treat all ESD employees the same, and that is that they would be required to have background checks if they have unsupervised contact with children. And finally, it would allow an ESD budget committee to be composed of people other than board members. This is the same, again, as the school district currently do. That's all I really have to say, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Tricia Smith. I am the Government Relations Specialist for Oregon School Employees Association, which represents classified employees in Oregon's K-12 Community College, ESD, and Park and Recreation District. And I'm here to speak to you about only the portion of Senate Bill 367, which deals with the fingerprinting of classified school employees within ESDs. This amendment was added to Senate Bill 367 in the Senate when I was over here with you enjoying some of the other issues that your committee has been dealing with, so I did not have an opportunity to speak to this on the Senate side. Had I known it was coming, I certainly would have. The only issue that I can, well, first of all, let me give you a little background. The legislature has been passing bills since 1995 that gradually have folded in school employees into requirements that they be fingerprinted and background checks done on those employees. OSEA has no objection to fingerprinting and background checks of school employees that have unsupervised interaction with students. However, classified school employees are not high-wage workers, and the one issue that we have in this bill deals with the cost of providing that background check. If you can imagine, these are people, in many cases, who have worked for ESDs for many, many years, and suddenly the law changes, and they are told that they have to spend $40 to have their fingerprints taken and background checks done to assure that they can continue to work with those children. Classified employees, OSEA members, there are about 16,000 of them. About 50% of those people make less than $15,000 a year. The cost is about $45 for fingerprinting, which doesn't seem like a lot unless you only make $15,000 a year, in which case it is a great deal of money, particularly money that is required to prove that you can continue to have your job. We feel that this is a cost that should be picked up by the district, because while we agree it's in the public's interest that fingerprints and background checks be taken, we don't feel that the employee should have to pay the cost of that background check. So we would ask the committee to please provide a little amendment to this bill that requires ESDs to pick up that cost. And with that, we would fully support the final implementation step of fingerprinting.
Maybe I missed something, and maybe it's not even important, but did you differentiate between employees who work with kids and employees who do not work with kids?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morris said, yes, there is a differentiation within the law. Those employees who do have unsupervised contact with students are required to be fingerprinted, but those who do not are not. For example, a night shift custodian is not required to be fingerprinted because that custodian would never have any interaction with children.
Now, would this change that? This would not change that.
Okay. No, Representative Morissette.
Yeah, do the Oregon School Boards Association agree with them paying the bill?
Mr. Chair, this bill that before you doesn't deal with Oregon School Boards Administration. It deals with ESDs. So we don't care what OSBA thinks. And he doesn't care either.
If I could clarify, last session you believed you passed this law. Unfortunately, because of another bill that passed, a small group of classified employees were not covered, and those are employees of certain education service districts. This merely says that all employees, all education service districts.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Winters.
Thank you. How many employees are we talking about, and what would the cost be to the ESDs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, I don't have any idea. That determination is made on a district-by-district basis based upon the employees who have direct unsupervised contact with children. So we don't make that determination how many are covered.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, I agree with that response. It is not possible for either of us to determine exactly how many employees this would fold in. However, we do understand, we do know that the cost is about $40 per employee, the cost to the employee without the amendment that we would ask for.
I think what we'll do, committee, is we'll pull this off and then bring it back later and give the administrators an opportunity to check out what those costs would be and how many people it might entail. Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 367, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 365. Mr. McMurdo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for your record, Greg McMurdo from the Department of Education. Senate Bill 365 increases the fees for private career schools that are licensed under 4 45 pay to the Department of Education. And for your information, private career schools are for-profit training schools that many of us have seen advertised on television frequently or other places, such as UCT and college when it was open, other schools. The program in the Department of Education that oversees the private career schools consists of 2.9 full-time employees with a budget of about $404,000 a year, or excuse me, a biennium. The program is supposed to be self-supporting from the fees that it generates, but for the last two biennia, we have been running a deficit in the program and have had to make up for it with general fund monies. The bill would increase the fees by 50%, and that's the first increase that we've had in this program since the 1993 session. The bill would generate about $135,000 annually in revenue. It's not significant, perhaps in terms of big budgets, but it would put the program on a paying for itself basis. The 2.9 employees in the program does license all private career schools in the state and sets the standards, minimum standards for schools to operate. It approves, in certain instances, instructors, periodically reviews all schools. It also handles student complaints either through mediation or with referrals to the Department of Justice. And very importantly, we also handle school closings, and that's important for instance when students oftentimes are due refunds of unearned tuition. The most recent large closure was Phelps College that involved a number of students who were able to either get their monies refunded or to get their federal guaranteed loans forgiven. In addition to that, this section manages the Tuition Recovery Fund, which is an insurance fund that the legislature set up in 1993. That is a self-insurance pool for closures and for the reimbursement of tuition from that fund. The section also serves as a federal liaison for the Guaranteed Student Loan Program. The bill is not opposed by the industry, and in fact, I'm not aware of any opposition to the bill.
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McMurdo, do we know how many schools, how many of these career schools do we have in the state?
There's about 212, I believe.
Thank you. Over how many years has this program been running a deficit?
It's been running a deficit for the last biennia. So we, including this biennia, so we would be going into our last year of deficit.
Follow. And on the average, what has been that deficit amount?
The same amount, Representative Winters, that this bill would raise, about $132,000 biennium.
Follow. Would we be coming back 2 years from now because of, you know, cost of inflation increases?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, I asked the same thing of our budget people, and they have told me no. Apparently, when the fees were increased in 1993, it was not a sufficient increase then, and the deficit seemed to grow right away. So we believe that this increase will last at least three more biennia before we move it back before you.
Follow. Most of, a lot of the agency budgets are coming in at least some period of where there is some reserve so that you're not running the risk of having a deficit. Did your budgeteers, when they came up with these figures, think of maybe having a three-month or six-month cushion?
Chair Representative Winters, I also asked that, and they indicated with these fees that they didn't believe a cushion was necessary, that the revenues were sufficiently were sufficient, that we did not need to build up a reserve.
On an individual basis, what if you're increasing the license fee, what is it actually going to go from? What number?
Sure, this is a statutory fee, and if you look at the bill, it gives you the current schedule and then what the new fee would be, which is why the bill is here rather than in ways it seems. But it is across the board 50%. We had talked with the schools about perhaps some increases being more than others, and the industry, the people that we talked to, said they would rather have it across the board as opposed to trying to select some that might have higher increases than others.
And there's no industry opposition to this.
No, there's not. Sure.
Mr. Chair? It does have a referral to Ways and Means.
Yes.
I'm aware that was the first thing came here.
Okay. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg, what's the... I'm a little perplexed at the rather dramatic increase in the cost for out-of-state schools. I assume this is a school that is has its charter out of state and operates a facility in state. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Jensen, that could be correct. It could also be an out-of-state school that is a correspondence school. But nonetheless, it would require them to recruit and teach through correspondence courses students in Oregon. The increase on out-of-state is the same as the increase on in-state.
Yes, I guess I recognize, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Recognize that, but it was not only to the increase, but also to the question of what resulted in more cost for licensing an out-of-state school than licensing an in-state school.
Sure, I'm not sure that there is a greater cost. Again, the increases were made uniform, and that was something that the schools asked for. So I'm charging a greater increase. And,
trying to figure out why it goes to Ways and Means if it doesn't have a general fund impact.
Mr. Chair, we would need an expenditure fund limitation increase to this program to match the revenues coming in from this bill. Other funds, called other funds limitation increase.
Got it. Okay. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 365. And I guess we'll go into a work session on Senate Bill 365. And we need to move this to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I would move Senate Bill 365 to Ways and Means.
Representative Starr moves Senate Bill 365 to Ways and Means with no recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Beck.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative Hobson.
Yes.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Coe.
No.
Representative
Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Dahl?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative
Winters?
Aye.
Representative Sears? Aye. Motion's adopted. We'll close the public hearing, or the work session on Senate Bill 365, and nothing further to come before the committee. Third term. All right. Ooh, what is that?